From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. April 30th marks the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon and the end of the Vietnam War. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we feature interviews with artists who helped us understand the war through their books, movies, photographs, and sculpture. We'll hear from National Book Award winner Tim O'Brien, who served in Vietnam as an infantryman. Photojournalists Horst Foss and Tim Page will tell us about being wounded while covering the war. Oliver Stone will remember his war experiences that influenced his movie Platoon. And Maya Lin will explain how she came up with her design for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Remembering Vietnam, coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The Justice Department says Attorney General Janet Reno is working with outside intermediaries in Miami on a possible agreement in which the U.S. relatives of Elian Gonzalez would restore the boy to his father. Spokeswoman Carol Floorman said the details of the plan are still being worked out and noted that the proposal has not been presented to the boy's father, Juan Miguel Gonzalez. Floorman wouldn't identify the intermediaries except to say that they're members of the Miami community. He said they're in contact with Elian's great-uncle, Lázaro Gonzalez. Attorney General Reno met briefly today with Elian's father but gave no timetable for the return of his son. In Miami, meanwhile, dozens of supporters kept up their vigil outside the home of Elian's Miami relatives, vowing that the boy is not going anywhere. Russian lawmakers have ratified another important arms control agreement, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports from Moscow.
The Duma voted overwhelmingly to approve the CTBT just 1 week after lawmakers ratified START II. This sudden interest in arms control treaties comes amid a U.S.-Russian dispute over Washington's plan to build a national missile defense. Moscow is trying to block this, and the Duma decision to ratify START II and the CTBT could strengthen Russia's hand in talks with Washington. The approval of the CTBT may also help Russia upstage the United States at a conference next week on nuclear nonproliferation. The Clinton administration failed last year to persuade the Senate to ratify the test ban treaty. Meanwhile, at the Kremlin today, acting President Vladimir Putin and his Security Council finalized a new military doctrine, which boosts the role of nuclear weapons. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Moscow.
Vice President Al Gore has announced a new initiative that would make heavy trucks and buses more fuel efficient. Jerome Vaughn of member station WDET has more from Detroit.
The vice president made the announcement in suburban Detroit, just a few miles from the headquarters of the Big Three automakers. Mr. Gore says the 21st Century Truck Initiative will work to double the fuel efficiency of 18-wheelers and other heavy trucks while lowering emissions. The vice president says the program will not only have environmental benefits, but will help the nation's economy as well.
This new partnership will end up saving businesses and truckers and taxpayers billions of dollars a year in reduced fuel costs, while at the same time cleaning the air and helping to combat global warming.
The research partnership hopes to produce truck prototypes using new technology within the next 10 years. For NPR News, this is Jerome Vaughn in Detroit.
Italy's president has asked Treasury Secretary Giuliano Amato to form a new government. Moderate leftist parties promised to support Amato during a vote of confidence in Italy's parliament. This is NPR News. Lawmakers in Alaska are fighting over a proposal to charge cruise ship passengers a $50 a head tax for traveling in state waters. The measure surfaced just one day after a state senator accused the industry of killing her own cruise ship-related proposal. Ann Sutton of member station KTOO in Juneau reports.
The head tax proposal emerged late in the session, just one day after Senate President Drew Pierce accused industry lobbyists of killing her bill that would have placed cruise ships under the state's oil spill response law. Senate Bill 308 sped through the Finance Committee Wednesday night before passing the Senate the next day. Pierce says it's not retaliation, but a fair and viable source of revenue that will go to fix up the state's ports and harbors. But State Representative Gail Phillips doesn't see it that way. She calls it a regressive attack on one industry, and she vows to kill the proposal in her Committee on Economic Development and Tourism. Phillips has posted a banner on her office door that says SB 308 has run aground. Pierce says nothing is dead until the session adjourns. For NPR News, I'm Ann Sutton in Juneau.
Jamil Abdullah Al-Amin is back in Atlanta to face charges in the murder of one deputy sheriff and the wounding of another. Al-Amin, known as black militant H. Rapp Brown during the 1960s, agreed to be returned to Georgia from Alabama today. His attorney said Al-Amin was willing to go back because he felt that what he called an atmosphere of hysteria in Georgia had died down. Al-Amin's attorneys say their client is a peace-loving Muslim cleric who was framed for the deputy's killing by corrupt police and gangsters after he tried to stop prostitution in a black community. This is NPR.
Support for National Public Radio comes from NPR stations and Amgen, advancing the frontiers of medicine and improving the lives of patients through biotechnology.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This month marks the 25th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam. On this archive edition, we hear from people who helped us understand the war through their novels, films, photos, and sculpture. There's nothing unusual now about seeing the war depicted in movies, TV, and books. But back when the subject of Vietnam was considered too risky, novelist Tim O'Brien was writing about it. He served in Vietnam in 1968 as an infantryman. His books include the 1973 memoir, If I Die in a Combat Zone, and the 1979 National Book Award winner, Going After Cacciato. I spoke with him in 1990, after the publication of his novel, The Things They Carried, a collection of Vietnam stories tied together by a fictional narrator whose name is also Tim O'Brien. In this passage, the narrator is reading a 17-page disjointed letter in which his former combat buddy writes about the problem of finding a meaningful life after the war.
I felt it coming, and near the end of the letter it came. He explained that he had read my first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, which he liked except for the bleeding heart political parts. For half a page, he talked about how much the book had meant to him, how it brought back all kinds of memories, the Vills and Paddies and Rivers, and how he recognized most of the characters, including himself, even though almost all the names were changed. Then Bowker came straight out with it. What you should do, Tim, is write a story about a guy who feels like he got zapped over in that shithole. A guy who can't get his act together and just drives around town all day and can't think of any damn place to go and doesn't know how to get there anyway. The guy wants to talk about it, but he can't. If you want, you can use the stuff in this letter, but not my real name, okay? I'd write it myself, except I can't find any words, if you know what I mean, and I can't figure out what exactly to say. Something about the field that night, the way Kiowa just disappeared into the crud. You were there. You can tell it.
Has anything like that actually ever happened to you, getting a letter from a friend or having a friend say to you, you've got to tell my story, I can't do it, but you've got to tell it?
Oh, it's happened hundreds and hundreds of times. I've never taken them up on the offer, and even in this case I didn't. The letter is made up.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel that people almost define themselves by maybe a half dozen or a dozen stories that describe the pivotal incidents in their life?
I do. In my own life, you know, I would say there are a handful, maybe a dozen incidents that are like touchstones that recur over and over in my fiction. There's one incident in the book, in my new book, about the shooting of a baby water buffalo in Vietnam. And the image of a defenseless water buffalo being shot over and over and over again is one that has appeared, I think, in everything I've written, or close to everything I've written. I'm not sure, you know, what the image is there for in terms of symbol or metaphor. Probably nothing. It just has the feel of meat, which was the feel of war. Flesh and blood. Poor baby buffalo being shot over and over and over again. That's senseless, you know. That's war.
Well, in the novel, the person who's shooting the buffalo, the water buffalo, is doing it after he's seen a friend of his die. You know,
yes.
one of his buddies die, and this is interpreted as a kind of not exactly revenge, but venting. some kind of venting of the frustration. Did you witness something like this? Is that why the image keeps recurring in your fiction?
Yeah, I did. I witnessed, we were walking along a paddy dike one day after a horrible, a few hours in a village adjacent to the village of Milai where the massacre happened. We lost several fellows who'd hit landmines. And the platoon was lined up in a long, long row across the paddy dike, and 100 yards away stood a water buffalo. And with no signal, the men began firing, and the buffalo stood there, and you could see gobs of flesh, you know, jumping off the beast. And it stuck.
Were you one of the men who fired?
No. I watched dumbly. I understood it. You can't justify something like that, but there was no enemy to take it out on. Men were feeling sorrow and rage simultaneously, and the buffalo was there to bear the brunt.
Although the narrator in your new novel, The Things They Carried, has the same name as you do, Tim O'Brien, you make it really clear in subtle ways throughout the book that this narrator is not really you, although you've given him your name. So you're always kind of challenging the reader to say, hey, make this connection between me and the narrator, but keep in mind the narrator isn't me at all. Why are you playing with us like that?
I love to play. Fiction should be fun. The idea came to me an hour or so at the typewriter. Instead of calling my protagonist Ernie or Fred, I typed the word Tim down. And it seemed that this had the possibility at least to be fun. Beyond that, it pushed me down inside myself. Although the events in the book are invented, the emotions and the passions of the book are from my heart. And by typing sentences with the word Tim in them, I found myself going down deeper and deeper and deeper into my memories of Vietnam, and coming up with a lot more. This book is the first book I've ever written that seems to me to touch my own heart, and I hope it'll touch the reader's heart too.
How vivid are your memories from the war? I mean, how much do you think you remember of what, the year that you were there?
Oh, a few scattered images. The way if you were to pick up a photographic album and page through it, you'd maybe 7 or 8 pictures would be, there. That would be really vivid. Another 24 or so you'd vaguely recollect. The rest of the album is empty. A lot of black pages. Which you'd expect, I think, that our memories leave us. But beyond that, a lot of the war was not memorable. Plodding along from village to village, hot days, mosquitoes. It was a kind of monotony to it, but a strange monotony, with boredom with a twist.
What was the twist?
The twist was a kind of, like a leaky faucet in your stomach, and I remember, instead of water, there was this acid feeling dropping out, where you can feel it just eating away inside you. You're bored, frightened simultaneously. Try it sometimes. It's tough.
Let me ask you about a couple of the images in the book and see where they come from in actuality or your imagination. I mean, what they signify to you. One of the men in the company, Henry Dobbins, is always wrapping his girlfriend's pantyhose around his head. It's his protective magic, his good luck charm.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of the men you know have something like that? Did you have anything like that yourself?
No, I didn't carry pantyhose, but there were talismans that men carried and wore. And the kind of talismans that touch on peace, the pantyhose business is wrapped around a fellow's neck as a kind of comforter, is a reminder of all that he doesn't have, his girlfriend, and the peace that girl represents for him. And, some men carried letters from home. Some men carried coins their father may have sent them. A lot of us carried photographs. Some carried lockets of hair.
What were the things that you carried with you to remind you of who you were and what it was that you loved?
I carried odd things. I carried you won't believe this, I carried a book of German grammar. I wanted to learn German while I was in Vietnam.
It seems like such a remote thing
what
to...
what an odd thing to be saying, you know, your spell, sprechen Sie Deutsch, and trying to get the accents right and learn the grammatical structures of German after, you know, marching all day long through really horrible things. It was a way of, it was a lot of us, you know, pushing the war aside, just, if even for a few moments.
Well, I guess it was also a way of, like, affirming that you had a life of the mind, that there was more besides, like, your body in the war.
Yeah, I think that was a great, great part of it, and a way of just touching on civility and civilization, which for me books represented then and continue to represent. I mean, that's what they are.
What else did you carry?
Oh, gee. Oh, I carried so much. I carried cans of orange juice that my father had sent me from Minnesota. These were just precious to me. He sent me 12 cans, and they were heavy. And it wasn't the orange juice I craved. It was the fact that these cans of orange juice had come from my dad from so far away. And I gave myself 1 month for each can. One can a month.
So you measured your whole tour of duty by those cans.
By those cans of orange juice.
Your first book, If I Die in a Combat Zone, was really one of the early war memoirs. When did it first come out? Was it 1973?
Yes.
And then Going After Cacciato came out a few years later. It was still one of the early Vietnam novels. Was it different for you writing about the war before Vietnam had so penetrated fiction, movies, and television?
I can't say that the output of recent books and movies and so on about the war has helped me or hindered me. I haven't seen many of the movies, and I haven't read many of the books.
I'm surprised to hear that. I thought you'd be curious either to see like what other people were doing with it, yeah, or to see if how it compared to your own experiences or your own telling of the experiences.
For me at least, I'm not much interested in war stories. Most of them tend to be melodramatic and mm-hmm. predictable and bad stories. And I think a lot of readers feel the same. We've been brought up in too many John Wayne movies and too much bad writing. This isn't true just for Vietnam, of course. It's true for if you look at love stories, look at all those Harlequin romances out there. But nonetheless, there's something about the war story that makes me want to turn my head and move away gently. For me, the war is, that isn't important to me now. What's important to me is language about the war and about the human heart. I was never a very good soldier. I hated that war. And it's now in the distant past. What's in the present for me are the stories that have really, in a way, nothing to do with the war. They're set in the war, but they're stories for me of friendships and ghosts and girlfriends and that kind of thing.
Tim O'Brien recorded in 1990 after the publication of his novel, The Things They Carried. Coming up, two photojournalists who were injured while covering the war in Vietnam. This is Fresh Air. Thirty-five photojournalists died or disappeared while covering the wars in Indochina, Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos. The 1997 book Requiem collects some of the extraordinary pictures they gave their lives for. The book was edited by two photojournalists who were wounded in Vietnam, Tim Page and Horst Voss. Page is an English freelance photographer who first started taking pictures of war in Southeast Asia at the age of 18. He was wounded 4 times while covering the war in Vietnam. Horst Voss is a Pulitzer Prize-winning German photographer. He was the Associated Press's chief photographer in Southeast Asia from 1962 to 1974 and is now the AP's senior editor in London. Page and Foss knew many of the photographers represented in the book Requiem. My first question was for Horst Foss.
Did you ever try to talk an AP photographer out of going to a certain place?
Oh, yes, many times. I mean, I myself spent about 50% of my working life in Vietnam in the field. That means I would go out 4 or 5 days and then stay in Saigon 4 or 5 days and play the editor for the others and then go out myself again and leave another photographer in at the editing desk. We took turns, so we all had our experiences there. I, being a little bit on the senior side already, and these days I was 30 and older, so older than many of the young colleagues, including my friend Paige. I try to warn people. I try to instill to them that they shouldn't go with bad troops. They should rather pull back and take care of themselves and look out for photos when situations became dicey, and never ever be foolishly risking chances.
What are bad troops?
Bad troops are troops that don't take care of themselves. Marines that don't dig in. Patrols that don't put out points. Companies that go through the jungle in single file without having flanks out. Troops that handle their weapons sloppishly. Artillery observers that don't check out the terrain properly, and so on.
Did you find that when you traveled with troops, that they looked after you, or did they see you as a burden? You know, someone who's not a member of the military who's tagging along.
That was one of the main features of a good combat correspondent, combat photographer, not to be a burden to the troops. It started with being equipped and dressed and like soldiers. It means you had to have the right boots and you have to have your own overnight gear and you have to carry your own food. The only thing you don't carry is your weapon. You had to protect yourself with a steel helmet and a flak jacket, just like they did. And when there was danger, you could not count on them putting a shield around you and defending you. No? You had to just run with them and hope for the best. But it was not our role to participate in the fighting. On the other side, among the communist photographers, that was their prime role. They were soldiers foremost and reporters, propagandists, or photographers secondary.
When you were photographing combat, what kind of rules of thumb would you use to know when to take pictures and when to just run for cover?
I think it's a cross purpose. You learn where you can. It's a sixth or seventh nature. You learn where you can take pictures from and be safe simultaneously. You learn how to move, where to position yourself. You learn how to shoot on the run. And this was the advantage of today's all thinking and singing camera and autofocus. You learn to anticipate. You learn to try to sort of preempt what's going to go on and where you can place yourself. It becomes a sixth or seventh sense in the end. You just automatically know where, you know that a rubber tree won't stop a bullet, so you don't hide behind a rubber tree. Admittedly, the opposition can't see you behind the rubber tree, but stray weaponry will come through that rubber tree.
Horst Foss, earlier we were talking about your responsibility as an editor at the AP. I'm wondering, when a reporter who worked with you at the AP died, what it was like for you to develop their last rolls of film, if you were able to find film on their bodies or in their cameras after their death?
Well, that's very, very difficult to say. I mean, of course, you hope that there is something on this camera that would be worthwhile to be sent out and be a last testimony to a man's a talent that wrote a very important chapter in the history of photojournalism in this century. When a man died, we looked back at his work and we tried to assess what he had achieved and what he had done in his lifetime. The last roll of film was simply like the last paragraph of a story. Of course it's sad, and of course it's everybody comes and looks at it and tries to understand what happened. There's a picture of a young Indian who traveled via Singapore. He desperately wanted to be a reporter, photographer with the AP. He lived only 14 days. When he was on his last military mission, he was up front at the point of a company and on a patrol, and a mine blasted into the company. He didn't have the experience to know that one mine seldom comes alone, so he stood up and photographed American medics helping dying soldiers. While he took his last six, seven, eight pictures, a second mine exploded and cut him down, standing up at the time and taking these pictures. So I remember very well his last roll. There were 18 negatives. And the last picture shows clearly that he stood and that he took a picture that he went out there to take, combat, that is. The picture almost explained his death. These last 18 negatives, I remember, were sent on orders from headquarters to the then general manager president of the AP. It was a very detailed explanation how Charlie Chalapa died. Our president wanted to know how it happened again that an AP man died. What could we do better to prevent the repetition of this? Well, there was no answer to my report because nothing was done wrong except that the man shouldn't have stood up after the first mine. So here, the last pictures were telling the tale, and as it happens, they are about the only pictures that are remembered of Charlie Chalapa, one of which is published, his last picture indeed, and published in our book, together with my slightly apologetic message to President Wes Gallagher, why Charlie Chalapa died.
Photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page recorded in 1997 after the publication of their book Requiem. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. From Alcatel, providing integrated voice and data networks for the internet, enterprises, and carriers worldwide, at www.alcatel.com. And from Island Records Def Jam Music Group, featuring I Am Shelby Lynn, from new recording artist Shelby Lynn. Available in stores or on the web, www.islanddefjam.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more with photojournalists Horst Voss and Tim Page about their experiences covering the war in Vietnam. Oliver Stone tells us about his war experiences and how he drew on them for his film Platoon. And Maya Lin talks about designing the Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. April 30th is the 25th anniversary of the fall of Saigon. On this archive edition, we're hearing from artists who help us understand the war through books, movies, sculpture, and photographs. Let's get back to our interview with photojournalists Tim Page and Horst Voss, recorded in 1997 after they edited a collection of pictures by photojournalists killed while covering the war in Southeast Asia.
Horst Voss, you were wounded in Vietnam. What was your wound and what impact did that have on your life, your work, your commitment to war photojournalism?
Well, I was wounded in December 1967 by a big rocket fragment that tore through my legs. And thanks to an American medic who somehow pulled me back, and thanks to a tank driver who moved forward and loaded me and brought me back to some clearing, and thanks to a helicopter pilot who came in and picked me up together with some other wounded, and thanks to surgeons who decided not to cut off my leg as I intended to do first, I was aware that I was on the way to recovery 4 or 5 days later. And the only decision I made at that time was not to go to Honolulu or New York or anywhere, but to stay in Vietnam. One reason being that I had total trust in military surgeons who were dealing with these problems day in, day out. And secondly, I tried to avoid having my legs broken again at the New York head office and being made a photo editor at headquarters, because that would have ended the great days of photography. Being in Vietnam and being around a major story of the time was always a great shot of adrenaline, and put it frankly, we enjoyed ourselves much of the time.
Well, Tim Page, I believe that you were injured and returned to combat more times than any other photojournalist in Vietnam.
I was hit 4 times, one train wreck and one motorcycle wreck and one car wreck. After 3 woundings, 2 of them relatively minor, I mean, in combat or out in the field. The third time was fairly serious when the American Coast Guard got shot up by American planes. About 400 pieces of shrapnel in my body. At that point, Time Life paid for me to leave the country. And I was given a contract to work out of the Paris office and cover the 60 war and other conflicts in the West. But I had to go back in 68 during the Tet Offensive, just after the Tet Offensive. I couldn't stand there and watch the Tet Offensive go on, as it were, live on television and seeing the pictures in Life magazine and all my buddies and friends' pictures being used, and I'm sitting in Los Angeles, thumb up my bum and mind in neutral. And I took a one-way ticket back to Vietnam, arriving just in time for the second Tet Offensive, when the press corps lost about 8 people in 3 days. And instantly I arrived with 50 cents in my pocket, and within 4 days I had 6 pages in Life magazine. It was something was bigger than we were. I mean, speaking from the freelance point of view, it was the war to be in, and providing you went out enough and got towards where it was hitting the fan, then you could guarantee getting decent spreads into magazines and sell your images, be it to AP or UPI or to one of the other agencies, or you would have a commission for an assignment to one of the major magazines. And that's what you're being paid for, or you were trying to break into that world so you became a known photographer.
Tim, what was the last wound that you got in Vietnam, and why did you stay?
I didn't stay. I mean, on the last wound, I took a piece of shrapnel in my brain, and they took out of my brain 200, about the size of an orange, 200 cubic centimeters of brain, which left me paralyzed, hemiplegic on the left side for over a year. When I was brought out of the field by helicopter and on the way to the next medical post, I was declared dead, and they had to jumpstart my heart a couple of times. And the hemorrhage at the point when they started opening my head up, as I said, got to the size of a large orange. And I was dead at that time, so I'm told. I mean, I can't actually recall much about that, to be quite honest.
How good has your recovery been?
It's a bit of a limp. I don't know if you ever really recover from something like that. You always, you recover physically. I mean, I've been back to Vietnam 27 times. I was there this year for 3 or 4 weeks. But my agility has always been impaired since. Mentally, I suppose it gives you the strength to go on and do other things, maybe something like this project. I mean, one can only say that, with the grace of God go I. I mean, one is alive, and you can't sit and somehow weep and gnash and wail about that dilemma in the past. It's over.
Horst Voss and Tim Page recorded in 1997 after the publication of Requiem, a book they edited featuring the work of photojournalists who died covering war in Southeast Asia. Coming up, Oliver Stone on serving in Vietnam and making the war movie Platoon. This is Fresh Air. In honor of the 25th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam, we're hearing from artists who interpreted the war. The movie Platoon is considered by many to be the film that best conveyed what it felt like to be a grunt in Vietnam. Although the film was enough to discourage anyone from fighting in a jungle war, the movie's writer and director, Oliver Stone, enlisted and asked to fight back in 1967. He won a Purple Heart. Stone drew on his Vietnam experiences again to direct Born on the 4th of July, the story of veteran Ron Kovic. His other films include Wall Street, The Doors, JFK, and Any Given Sunday. Let's start with a clip from Platoon. Charlie Sheen plays a soldier who's just arrived in Vietnam. This is a letter to his grandmother.
Somebody once wrote, "Hell is the impossibility of reason." That's what this place feels like, hell. I hate it already, and it's only been a week. The hardest thing I think I've ever done is go on point 3 times this week. I don't even know what I'm doing. A gook could be standing 3 feet in front of me and I wouldn't know it. I'm so tired. We get up at 5 a.m., hump all day, camp around 4 or 5, dig a foxhole, eat, then put out an all-night ambush or a 3-man listening post in the jungle. It's scary because nobody tells me how to do anything because I'm new. Nobody cares about the new guys. They don't even want to know your name. The unwritten rule is a new guy's life isn't worth as much because he hasn't put his time in yet. And they say if you're going to get killed in the NAM, it's better to get it in the first few weeks. The logic being, you don't suffer that much. If you're lucky, you get to stay in the perimeter at night. And then you pull a 3-hour guard shift. So maybe you sleep 3-4 hours a night, but you don't really sleep.
Charlie Sheen in Oliver Stone's film Platoon. I spoke with Stone in 1990.
The main character in Platoon drops out of college, and his analytical reason that he gives one of the soldiers who thinks that, he's crazy for being this middle-class kid in the war. So the reason the Charlie Sheen character gives is, why should only the poor people fight? What was your reason for enlisting?
Well, that was part of it. I felt a sense of that it was the war was somehow wrongly fought. If you could go to college to escape it. That if a war should be a democratic country, supposedly, therefore it should be fought along democratic principles. That means everybody goes, including senators' sons and the bankers' sons. And I think that deeply bothered my sense of idealism about this country. And I did feel an obligation that I had to serve. I left Yale University and... There were other reasons, too. It wasn't just a sense of idealism. And there was personally, I did feel obligated. I wanted to see the war. I wanted to see war as a concept because I'd read about it in books and Hemingway. And I have to admit, it had a romantic appeal to me. And I knew it was going to be the last war of my generation, and I wanted to be there. I wanted to be part of the passion and peril of our times, as Oliver Wendell Holmes said,
How soon did it lose that romantic appeal?
First day in the bush, I cut point. I think in the 25th, they put up the new guys right up, like in the movie. And I think I lost that sense of You know, it was pretty, it was clear to me in the first few days that the guys there were not really fighting for an objective or with any kind of morale. They were fighting just to count the days until they left. So everybody in the unit would have, I got 85 days to go, I got 165 days to go. You know, everybody would talk about the days left, which is not the right way to, you know, to really fight a war.
Your father was a stockbroker. You'd gone to prep school in Yale. Were your parents pleased that you had enlisted? Is that what they wanted for you?
No, they were horrified. Dad was a big believer in fighting communism, and until they took his own son, you know, he didn't. No, they thought I should stay in college. It was crazy to give that up.
Was there an element of rebellion against your parents in the act of enlisting?
That was probably the third part of the whole thing. Was that it was something that they didn't want me to do, therefore I had to do it because. To be honest, I'd had it with my parents. You know, I'd had it with that whole way of life. Something was wrong in the American system that as I had been educated to, and I think I was turning my back on the world as I knew it. I knew that it was, I didn't know what else there was, but I knew what I didn't want, which was to become some version of what my father was. Since then, I've grown to respect him enormously for what he's done, mm-hmm. and to see the things he went through. And understand better, but at that time I was pretty angry.
Were you a physical person, and did you feel like that you could handle yourself well physically when you got to Vietnam?
I thought I could. Yeah, I was a good athlete, and I did learn ultimately. At first, I don't think anybody's a great soldier right off the bat. I mean, combat conditions are so intense and unplanned for that you never can tell what's going to happen. And I got shot the first time in a major, in my first night ambush, I got shot, and then I got shot a second time. After that, I got pretty smart in a bush, and I could move well without being hurt. I was carrying a lot of weight. I would carry 60, 70 pounds, or sometimes less. And, you know, but there is no question that the NVA, the North Vietnamese Army, were probably the best light infantry, you know, up to that time. I mean, there were great soldiers, too. And I'm not saying we were bad. I think that we did a good job, but we were up against people that we could travel very light, you know, eat rice and didn't need hot baths or showers and didn't need hot food. You know, they lived close to the ground. We had too much. In Vietnam, we had too many support troops. It was 6 or 7 to 1. You know, we had too much rear echelon. I think the war, if assuming that it was going to be fought, and I don't think it should have, but it should have been fought more in a commando-style way, Israeli army kind of way.
What was the feeling about being in a jungle war that you most wanted to communicate in platoon?
Point of view, the subjectivity, the sense of fear and chaos that you could understand what war really is, the confusion, the fact that maybe 20% of what happens in the people who get killed in a war get killed by their own friendly fire. The sense of fear and panic and heroism too. There's daily acts of heroism. There's a bonding between the men. There was very much a split in Vietnam that I noticed. I was in 4 different platoons. I was in the 1st Cav and the 25th. And in all platoons, there was like a mini civil war going on. There was sort of the people that kind of believed in it, and the lifers, and then the people that, you know, were just draftees. There was the guys who smoked a little pot, and there were guys who drank too much. There was guys who liked Smokey Robinson. There was guys who liked country music. But there was generally a political split, you know. There was a certain element of racism, mm-hmm. very strong racism towards the Orientals from portions of the platoon, you know, that they were less than human. And a lot of the other guys were more tolerant and humanitarian. So I found that interesting. I kind of thought that it reflected, in some ways, the split I saw in the United States when I went back to the country.
The kind of confusion that you're talking about in the middle of a jungle war, you captured that both in platoon and in Born on the 4th of July. Can you talk a little bit about choreographing a scene so that what you get watching it is the sense of confusion of not knowing, not being able to see, yeah. not knowing who's fire you're in the middle of or who you're firing at. But from your perspective as a director, everything has to be completely controlled to communicate that confusion.
Well, it's very important to show that confusion. Very important. You do not see the enemy very often. In fact, in the movies that I made, you see them a little too much. Uh-huh. Because I always had to, you know, I have to compromise to some degree with the needs of an audience, but it's even more difficult to see them.
In real life,
in a movie is to bring somebody who's firing at you a little closer to camera so that you can at least see some outlines. In real life, it was probably more invisible and dirtier and even more surprising. And death is even worse than it is on the screen. I mean, death is so, you know, it's pretty ugly. And it smells bad, too. I got Dale Dye to work with me. He's an ex-Marine, and he was real helpful. You know, we'd walk the terrain, and you basically plot it out, do your homework. But we kept it spontaneous. We had a terrific cameraman, Bob Richardson. We had some great Steadicam operating. We did Bourne. We did completely different than Platoon.
What were the differences?
I wanted to go with a beach. I wanted to go with a yellow, blinding cause sky, because I worked up in the first Cav, up in the beach areas in the North First Corps. And I remember patrolling those beaches, and there were little dangers there that you don't get in the jungle. And the sense of the sun, it reminded me of Camus' Stranger, and that Kovic would lose it, you know. He would just lose it in the sun and shoot his own man, you know, because he'd be blinded by the sunspots and sort of the panic, that crazy intent. You know, you don't, when the bullet flies, the human beings all respond the same. The eyes tighten. The brains kind of go dead a little bit. You don't think that much, you know, when you're under fire. So we tried to do Bourne real different than Platoon because people had seen a lot of the jungles. I think that's one of the things I'm real proud of in Bourne is the ocean and the beach and the village.
Is there any one story that you would always tell the actors who you worked with in those movies about what the war was like?
No, we put them through training. We put them through training. And
right.
It was important that they not sleep. I remember in Platoon, and we put them through 12 days with Dye up in the Philippine bush. And I really insisted. I said, I don't want this well-slept look that I see in war movies. I want these guys to look tired and beaten. And you can't fake that for some reason. You can't put makeup under their eyes. You got to give them a sense of what it's like not to sleep for a year. You don't sleep at night. You get three hours if you're lucky. And 2 hours here, but you're always sleeping with radar on. So that's where you get that kind of vacant look. So we put him in the bush, and we worked him around the clock. We made him, you know, pull guard and duty and sentry duty all night. And they came out. They were so angry and irritable. That's the irritability of infantry all over the world at any time. It's a given. And I think we caught that, and the guys got it. But you can never teach an actor exactly what it's like, you know. But they are very imaginative actors, and they are able to cross that gulf and imagine. But there's no substitute for actually being there.
Director Oliver Stone, recorded in 1990. Coming up, Maya Lin, the designer of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. This is Fresh Air. On today's archive edition, we're hearing from artists who helped us understand the war in Vietnam through literature, movies, photographs, and sculpture. We conclude with Maya Lin, who designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. Visitors are often moved to tears as they find the names of loved ones among the names of the nearly 58,000 dead and missing inscribed on the monument's granite walls. Lin designed the monument when she was a 20-year-old architecture student. Her design was chosen in a competition that drew over 1,400 entries. Lin is the daughter of Chinese-born parents, a family of artists and scholars.
Her parents fled China in the 40s and located in Ohio. Here's a clip from the Academy Award-winning documentary about Maya Lin. She's reading from the one-page proposal she wrote, explaining what she was trying to communicate through her design for the memorial.
The memorial is composed not as an unchanging monument, but as a moving composition, to be understood as we move into and out of it. The passage itself is gradual, the descent to the origin slow. But it is at the origin that the meaning of this memorial is to be fully understood. At the intersection of these walls, on the right side at the wall's top, is carved the date of the first death. It is followed by the names of those who have died in the war in chronological order. It is up to each individual to resolve or come to terms with this loss. For death is in the end a personal and private matter. And the area contained within this memorial is a quiet place meant for personal reflection and private reckoning.
In 1995, I asked Maya Lin if she's ever surprised by people's reactions to her Vietnam Veterans Memorial.
I think the one thing I could never have predicted in a million years is how people leave objects at the place. But the reality is whenever I make a piece, no matter what, all I'm concerned about is how one person one-on-one is going to dialogue with the piece. I have actually never thought about any of my works in terms of a collective general response. And in that sense, I'm very private, and I always think of these works as being very private. And no matter how public they are, one experiences them one-on-one.
You were a student when you did the proposal for the Vietnam Memorial. Did you expect to get a grade instead of a commission?
I got a grade. And then I decided to enter it in the competition.
Oh, you did get a grade first.
Oh, I did.
What was your grade?
No, I'm not going to say.
Oh, come on.
It was a grade for the entire course. It's I got a B. He didn't like my work. The professor thought it was all too strong.
Too strong?
Uh-huh.
What's bad about being strong?
I don't know. I think he preferred... it was a course on funereal architecture. I think... at the time, I was doing a lot that dealt with conceptual levels of experiencing mourning, and my works came off. Again, it was that same comment. We want something happy, not something sad. And I wanted to do things not necessarily sad, but I wanted to do things that were very focused on truth and how you could only have a catharsis if you go through some sort of a painful acceptance or acknowledgement of the pain of a loss or something like that.
You were pretty young when you designed the memorial to really understand the sense of catharsis and loss and reflection that you expressed so well in the piece. And I was wondering if this was just kind of purely artistic impulse or if you'd been through that kind of experience yourself.
I wouldn't call it an artistic impulse. I think it was an abstract impulse. I mm-hmm. think I understood, though I had never gone through an actual loss due to death. I hadn't experienced it myself. I felt at the time it was going to be the most painful thing to lose someone. And then how can you bring someone back? And my attitude was a name will bring everything back about that person you ever knew.
And that's why you went for a wall of names.
Well, no, the names were also required as part of the competition. But, see, I actually designed it for a class and then entered it. It just seems that it worked, that what they wanted and what I had designed worked out. And I knew it wasn't going to win. So I was doing it more to make a statement. I was doing it for myself. But there was no way that it would ever get selected.
When your design won the contest for the Vietnam Veterans Memorial, people who didn't like the design called it a degrading ditch, a wall of shame, a black scar. Ross Perot, who in part funded the competition, organized a demonstration against your design. You were still a young artist. Did you take this personally? What did it do to your sense of confidence in yourself as a person, in your own work?
I guess I wouldn't even say I was a young artist. I was still forming. I hadn't even understood how much art was going to pull me. I just believed in it. I think the one graceful thing about youth is that you are so, so sure that you are right, that in that what you're doing is good. I think I really believed the truth of accepting all these names and being able to experience it in a certain way would really be helpful. And that's all I believed in at the time. And I think perhaps had I been older, doubt would have begun to creep in. But I think when you're that young, you're incredibly stubborn.
At the dedication ceremony, your name was never mentioned. And the program book had a picture of the statues, not of the monument you designed. How did you feel about that?
Pretty upset. I was more upset that my family was there and we were horribly shunted off into a press box with cameras all around. And it was just very unpleasant, an experience. It's the only time in all the dedications since where there was just so much almost not acceptance of authorship of the fact that I had authored this piece. It's almost like, now we like it. It's now ours. And it was painful to know that you had fought so hard to get something through, not because of ego, but because you believed in something and to have that happen. But I think what then happened with, say, the dedication of the Civil Rights Memorial was the exact opposite of that. And I think sometimes you have to persevere, and the next time out, it sort of makes up for it.
Maya Lin designed the Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. Our interview was recorded in 1995. April 30th is the 25th anniversary of the end of the war in Vietnam. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today was Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From World Wildlife Fund, known by its panda logo, working in more than 100 countries around the globe to leave our children a living planet. On the web, worldwildlife.org. From Reel.com, an online source for movies, offering over 100,000 titles on VHS and DVD. On the web at reel.com. AOL keyword REEL. And from Random House Inc. Style Press Division, publisher of The Running Mate, a new novel of politics by Joe Klein, author of Primary Colors. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, wrestler Bret the Hitman Hart. He's from one of wrestling's most famous families. His father was a wrestling promoter. His brother Owen Hart was killed in a 50-foot fall while performing a stunt in the ring. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.